I call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members, take your seats. If you're in here, the chair recognizes a quorum is present. Today, we've got five bills, and based on who we have here, I think we'll do a non-controversial one. It should be. Now, the revisor's bill is not controversial for you guys, is it? Okay. All right. So let's get started on this. Oh, this is my bill, right? Is this my bill? Yeah. Yes. Okay. So I'll just present it from the chair. Yes. The author's amendment is to take out the bonding provisions, because if we don't, the revisor's bill needs 3/5 vote on the floor. So we're going to avoid that. So so what's my amendment? Oh, Chair Considine. Okay, so which number is this?
This is 1065.
1065. So the author's amendment is the A19-0219. That's the right amendment. Is that right, gentlemen? Okay, so I offer that. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, wait. Yes, Chair Scott.
I don't think that we can adopt anything or pass anything without a quorum.
We've got a quorum.
We recognized one.
Unless it's challenged. Are you going to challenge a quorum, Chair Scott?
keeping the line moving.
I'm not going to say anything.
Okay, thank you. So I move that House File, I move that House File 1065, as amended, be placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Good. Thank you very much. Okay. Representative Mueller is not here. Representative Moran is not here. Representative Vang is not here. Okay. Who else do we have that we can go on? Well, does anybody have a joke? Representative Morrison, please take your seat up there. Is it going to be? Let's do the minutes.
So moved.
Okay, Chair Considine moves the minutes of March 14th. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes of March 14th are passed. Where's my agenda? Here we go. Okay. Okay, so Prescription Drug Price Transparency Act. We're on House File 1246. Representative Morrison, is there a motion to move House File 1246? And the motion is?
Recommend
that it be re-referred to Ways and Means. So Representative Neuer moves that House File 1246 be recommended to move. And we have no amendments, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Morrison, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The rationale for House File 1246 is simple. The cost of prescription drugs is high and growing higher. As a percentage of the healthcare dollar, rising prescription drug prices have overtaken inpatient hospital costs with no signs of abating. New drugs coming to market have exorbitantly high launch prices. The prices of older drugs are increasing significantly. Lowering drug prices is a priority for Minnesotans. Creating more transparency of drug prices is an important first step toward raising awareness of the role of drug prices in healthcare and helping to drive down drug prices. This Drug Price Transparency Initiative is supported by a broad coalition of stakeholders and is co-authored by a large bipartisan group of legislators. The goal of the bill is to require drug manufacturers to provide greater transparency of drug prices. It requires price transparency for three categories of drugs: existing drugs, new drugs, and newly acquired drugs. And it also imposes monetary penalties, and I think this is why I'm before your committee today, and enforcements for manufacturers who fail to comply with these new reporting requirements. Manufacturers must report in a timely fashion or be fined up to $10,000 per drug per day for late or incomplete information. Any civil penalties will be deposited into the Healthcare Access Fund. We sought this level of penalty to ensure compliance on the part of drug companies. This level of penalty is the same as in the state of Oregon. This bill is designed to be consistent with the other states that have enacted the legislation, which should make it easier for drug manufacturers to report given these requirements in other states. Similar drug price transparency legislation is being considered in other states as well. There is a need to know why drugs are so expensive so that as policymakers, we can drive better public policy for patients across Minnesota. This bill has broad bipartisan support and a broad coalition of organizations support it. I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Do you have any testifiers with you?
I believe that I do.
Everyone raise your hand if you're going to testify on this bill.
Rick Varco was planning to be here.
You don't have to. Like, it's not compelled.
Yeah. I think there are people here who may be able to answer a question.
Okay. Are there questions? Questions for the bill author or anyone else? I don't see any questions. Oh, Chair Johnson, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, prescription drugs are available in the state with some of the things going on here. But I'm wondering, and I know it's a little bit outside of the realm of this committee, but it's the first time I've had an opportunity to hear this bill and studying it. Can the manufacturers factor in the cost of the mandates in this report into the cost of their drugs?
Representative Morrison.
Chair Lesh, Representative Johnson, I'm trying to, I don't think so, I guess is my best answer to that question.
Chair Johnson.
Yeah, because I'm wondering, this is cost that it costs the effect of the price of the drugs and the price of research and development. I do have a few concerns that this might limit the number of prescription drugs that come to the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Morrison? Seeing none, then was it Representative Noor's motion? Representative Noor moves that House File 1246 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes.
Division.
Division's been called. All in favor of the motion, raise your hand. Count four. All opposed, raise your hand. I'm sorry, Representative Morrison, the motion fails. Representative Morrison, we have some members on the DFL side that have a little bit of trouble making it here on time. And it's my apologies that your bill had to suffer this fate. It's not my intention to recess the committee so that members can be at committee on time. I did not expect that this would happen, but perhaps we can offer an amendment on the floor, Representative Morrison. We could have an option to challenge quorum, but the vote was already taken, so the effective quorum challenge would be after that vote. We can talk offline, Representative Morrison, about this later, and perhaps we can have an option on the floor of this, but you may want to have a conversation with the members that couldn't see fit to be at committee on time. My apologies.
Thank you for hearing the bell.
Thank you. One moment. Committee's in recess. To the call of the chair, it'll probably just be a few minutes. Not nothing we can do. So the next bill, we can continue to kill bills.
It's just the summary. The amendment? Yeah.
That this is, there's no excuses for this. Rachel, there is not an excuse to be, it's like everyone's got a reason to do it. I'm sick with the food, I can do it at home.
I was with my 21-year-old daughter. She's like, oh.
Well, that's, it's my side's fault. It's not your side's fault. So.
And it's posted as well. Yeah, I know, yeah, there's a lot of that.
I just called Adam, who's like three members on, right around.
Say again?
I just called my LA, CLA, and told them to hustle around the floor, on the fourth floor. Just three or four of them. There. I don't believe Carlos is, he said he had a conflict, I know. Kelly's not coming either. Okay.
There's the bill, there's the elections bill also, and it has the names chapter 13.
I asked him to shake, try to find Hunter, Jay, Sean.
Or wait, yeah.
Where's Rena Moran or Representative Vang?
Jay Jung.
You said that Kelly Moeller is gone. Who's presenting her bill?
John, I've got 1955.
Yeah, I mean, we'll roll the dice on that one.
Well,
see what happens.
You're
going to have to be. We're not waiting for you too. Committee's back in. We have House File 1955, Predatory Offender Registration Provisions Amended, Statewide Emergency Communication Board Provisions Modified. Representative Carlson will be presenting on behalf of Representative Moeller. The motion from Representative Carlson on House File 1955 is that it be, what's the motion? That it be referred to public safety. Here we go. Is that your motion, Representative Carlson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Carlson. To your bill, do we have an amendment? Okay, go ahead to your bill, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair and members, this is the Department of Public Safety Agency Bill, House File 1955, dealing with predatory offender registration changes. For the committees, just to keep us kind of in line with today's conversation, I'll quickly run through the sections that are, and again, if staff wants to chime in too, but the sections that are pertinent to judiciary purview are Section 1. Section 1 authorizes the use of driver's license photograph to search an individual required to register as a predatory offender. I'm sorry, a predatory offender, yes. Then we have Section 4. Section 4 modifies Section 243.166 subdivision 2 to correct the name of the form and to direct that if an individual required to register does not have a corrections agent. A corrections agent, by the way, is a
probation
agent. Thank you. Local law enforcement with jurisdiction over the individual's primary address will provide notice to the registrations required. Sections 11 and 13 also fall within the purview of judiciary. Sections 11 and 13 are data sharing provisions that govern predatory offenders' data. Both are being amended to cover a sharing of corrections agents to Child Protection that was enacted in Section 244.057 in 2005. Oh. Looks like we have a... Looks like Chair Lesh came through with his shamrock shakes.
I'm sorry, I was looking at a shamrock
shake. I was too, Mr. Chair. It's, yes.
Go ahead, Mr. Carlson. Did you have a...
Just a few more, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So that was Sections 11 and 13. And then finally, Section 12. Section 12 lists the events that make an offender not in compliance with registration requirements and so prompt the BCA to make information public about that, the individual, this is in parentheses, who is over 16 years old and out of compliance for 30 days more. The list is the same as the list in Section 10. So those are the sections we'd like to direct your attention to and that fall under the purview of this committee. Mr. Chair, at this time, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Katie Engler. I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As Representative Carlson has indicated, there are five sections in the bill that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. I'd like to begin by saying that all data about predatory offenders is classified as private data on individuals, but for the data that are authorized to be made public when an individual is noncompliant, as just described by Representative Carlson. Section 1 would authorize the use of a driver's license photograph in order to locate individuals required to register as a predatory offender. Section 4, which I understand relates, the issue here within your jurisdiction, relates to accessibility of the notification that would be provided by law enforcement if the offender required to register does not otherwise receive notice from courts or from a probation agent. And we believe that law enforcement would be meeting those accessibility requirements. Sections 11 and 13 are the two provisions that classify the data about predatory offenders as private. As Representative Carlson indicated, in 2005, probation agencies passed some language that authorizes them to share predatory offender information with Child Protection. Unfortunately, they also did not fix the two sections that govern the predatory offender data in both Chapter 243, or 299C. And finally, Section 12 is the language that gives the Bureau authority to make public data about individuals who are not in compliance. The idea is to have the public help us find those individuals so that we can help them return to compliance. And what we're doing is making clear what events are the triggers that would cause someone to not be in compliance, and therefore, if they are 16 years or older and have been out of compliance for 30 days or more, what would then prompt us to post that information on the public website. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Engler? Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, members, the vast majority of this bill was passed out of this body last year and unfortunately vetoed by the governors. The issues were well vented as well last year, and I want to thank Representative Carlson for bringing this stuff forward and the original author, so it's a good bill.
Thank you. I'm sorry, was that last part a question, Chair Johnson?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Engler or the or Mr. Representative Carlson? Okay. Before we anyone else from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 19, what is this? House File 1955. Okay. Are you guys going to kill this? Okay. Good. We'll vote on it then. The motion on House File 1955 is that it was my motion that it be re-referred to public safety and criminal justice reform. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero.
I just want to thank you for the shamrock shake. I love shamrock shakes, and I didn't want to break with tradition, so I'm very appreciative of that. When it first came, I didn't see any straws, so I was starting to sweat. I didn't want it to be like a salad without silverware. So, but having the straws are.
I get that.
We were going to hold off on the straws so you drink it, Reps and Lucero, and have, like, some stuff in your mouth. And then you could say, like, Dr. Evil, I know, that's how we drink it in Belgium. We call it a Belgian dip. No one remembers.
Mr. Austin Chair.
Powers. Chair Scott.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you as well for the Shamrock Shakes. They're very delicious, and it's the breakfast of champions.
Well, Chair Scott, so the epic quest that was had to retrieve these Shamrock Shakes and bring them henceforth was done by Ms. Letitia Townsend.
Thank you, Letitia.
And she had to brave the cold and ice puddles, as well as transportation issues, not to mention the issue of getting them back and forth from the SOB to here. So she did a great job on that. And Chair Scott, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we strike the language modified by the A3 to the omnibus bill yesterday, 631, and reinstate the DE language.
Well, Chair Scott, while I support that amendment, I don't think we can do that because the bill is now out of our possession.
All right.
But they showed up to kill your bill in committee, but they didn't show up to support their own colleague this morning. So we already passed that out. So
thank you.
Is what it is.
Mr. Chair?
Chair Considine.
I noticed there's a lot of extra Shamrock Shakes, and there's at least one small testifier here. Maybe would you be amenable?
Well, I think we got an extra.
Oh, yeah.
We got to have an extra, right? Is there an extra?
With her father's permission, of course.
Of course. Good call, Chair Considine.
Let's make it happen.
Okay, so we have Representative Vang here with industrial hemp. Well, our industrial hemp bill.
I would pass them if I could.
Right. Okay, welcome to the committee, Representative Vang. Let me just check and see, find out what the motion on this is first, where we're sending it. Yeah, okay. So the motion on this, I'll move Representative Vang that House File 1661 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. I see no amendments.
Nope.
So Representative Vang, tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of committee. I'm happy to be here to present 1661 before the committee. The passage of the latest federal farm bill took hemp off the Controlled Substances Act and therefore legalizing it as an agricultural commodity. We can now take this opportunity with this bill by opening new markets for industrial hemp. 1661 authorizes Minnesota hemp growers the opportunity and regulatory framework necessary to sell their hemp to Minnesota's two current medical cannabis manufacturers, which is already a ready-made market for hemp producers. Before then, hemp was only regulated for research under the industrial hemp pilot project. This created a lack of market opportunities. And with the growing now that's legalized and with the growing popularity and interest in the now legalized industrial hemp, this will open new doors for new markets and is critical to realizing the full potential and economic impact of the hemp industry in Minnesota. So Section 8 is the crux of this proposal relevant to this committee. It is pretty straightforward. This authorizes departments MDH and MDA to work together to verify licensing, inspection, and compliance of hemp growers. The remainder of this bill has already been thoroughly heard in Agriculture Policy and Finance Committee and as well as Health Policy Committee. So I want to thank you members for the opportunity in creating a new market and ask for your support in creating a new market for opportunities for Minnesota hemp growers. I do have a few testifiers here today to speak in support of this bill.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Strofus. I reside in Hastings, Minnesota. We've been a licensed hemp grower in the state since 2016, which was the first growing season. We were the first to go through the process with the Department of Agriculture. We've grown approximately 100 acres and contracted about 75% of the production in the state. We're also active in North Dakota and Wisconsin. We started Minnesota Hemp Farms to focus exclusively on industrial hemp and have been predominantly focused on the grain markets. We sell about a semi-load of processed hemp goods per month now, and we provide a growing platform for farmers and a outlet for their crop. The other side of the market from grain is with regard to hemp extracts, which are sold as a dietary supplement. And there's no doubt a direct-to-consumer market for that for growers if they want to do that. We have processors now online in the state to do that. But in addition to that, having the opportunity to sell product in the wholesale market to the existing medical cannabis providers is a new market opportunity. And so this bill would allow us to do that, and we're very supportive of that as a new market opportunity. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier? Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much of the hemp production goes towards clothing?
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, and tell me your name again for the record. It was
John Strophus.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Strophus. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Right now, the fiber market is emerging, but we do not have a significant market for that at this time. It's one of the things Canada has been trying to establish for about 20 years. There's some things that we're doing and working with some companies to get that mobilized. And I think in the next year to 24 months, we'll see significant improvement in fiber market opportunities.
Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope so. Pretty much everything I wear is 100% cotton. Can't stand too many of the other things, but I've seen some of the material made out of hemp, and it appears to be quite comfortable. Thanks.
Questions for Mr. Strophus or for the author? Mr. Representative Cantrell, did you have a question earlier?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. To the testifier, out of curiosity, is the production of industrial hemp treated in a way that's disparate to the manner in which any other type of crop is treated in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Strophus.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Certainly, it is treated differently at this point. There's a license process, background checks for growers. Obviously, we don't have that for corn and wheat and soybeans. So that is problematic in the sense of another barrier that a farmer would have to go through. I think to this point, that's been reasonable. With the passage of the 2018 Farm Bill at the federal level, there's really not an ounce of daylight between corn and soybeans and industrial hemp. And I would hope that at some point our policy and licensing and protocols within the state would align with that spirit and reduce regulation and fees and so forth that are burdensome to growers at this point. But at this point, Minnesota, I tell around the country when I speak on panels, is one of the best places in the country to grow industrial hemp, and I believe that North Dakota, Minnesota, and Wisconsin will be the top producing hemp states long term.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for that answer, and I certainly hope that we can reconcile our laws with the new farm bill that was passed this past year. Hemp is an incredibly sustainable product, and it doesn't deplete the soil nearly as much as some other types of crops do. So I thank you so much for your testimony today.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if we could draw our attention to page 5.22 to 5.24. I think that's the reason that this bill is in our committee. And it talks about data sharing between the Commissioner of Agriculture. Let's see, the Commissioner. The Commissioner of Agriculture, and who's the other commissioner that we're talking about here?
It'll be MDH.
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'll be MDH, since medical cannabis is currently housed under the Health Department.
Okay. So just wondering, thank you, Mr. Chair, if you could elaborate on what kind of information, it says that they're going to be verifying licensing information, and what kind of information is contained within the license?
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative, for the question. I did ask Whitney, the Assistant Commissioner, to be here to testify. I'm not sure if she's in the room to talk more about what kind of information or data sharing. But this is really to ensure that any hemp obtained by the medical cannabis manufacturer is from growers licensed and regulated by the State of Department of Agriculture.
Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, and I don't know if the testifier, if he would know what kind of information is in a license.
Mr. Schroffus.
With respect to sharing of information, I can't speak to what the intent is on specific fields of data, but generally in the industry, you're asked to provide a license, so it's your name or company name, address, and basic public contact information that would be generally available on any website that you would have for your business in that area, with license number and potentially location of the field. That may be something that would be shared between the department and a company trying to validate.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Chair.
Scott.
And I'm just wondering if we could, if Mr. Hopkins could weigh in on this, if he knows about any of the, it sounds like all of this is public information anyway, but if he could just maybe confirm that the licensing information, inspection information, and compliance-related information would all be already public.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair and members, so under Chapter 18K, which is the chapter regarding the licensing of industrial hemp growers, a license application filed by a grower includes the name and address of the applicant and the legal description of the land area or areas where industrial hemp will be grown by the applicant. There is background check information required for the licensure as well. It's not clear in the bill on whether that's something that's subject to these data sharing arrangements under 5.22. I'm not super familiar with this chapter. I'm not seeing a special data classification for this information. I will let you know if I find one as I go through the rest of the chapter. But, of course, if data is not classified as private or non-public, then it is public by default under the Minnesota Data Practices Act. So, hold on. Criminal history records subject to the background check rule are private. The rest of the licensing information does not appear to have a special data classification, which means it would be public by default.
Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And so to the bill's author, Representative Vang, is it necessary for, in this data sharing, for one commissioner, the Commissioner of Agriculture, to see, well, who does the background check? The Minnesota Department of Health does that? Or does the Minnesota Department of Agriculture do the background checks?
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair and members, the commissioner has to require the background check, but the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension actually performs the background investigation.
Chair Scott.
Thank you. So, Mr.
Commissioner of Agriculture,
Okay.
requires the background check for licensure, but the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension performs the background
check. Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Chair, to Representative Vang, is it necessary for the Commissioner of Agriculture to share the background check information with the Department of Health in this data sharing arrangement?
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would believe so. This is to ensure that hemp growers are in good compliance with the regulatory framework or the regulations of the Department of Agriculture. That way, I believe the manufacturer can feel free to say that this is from a reliable source.
Chair Scott.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, thank you for that. I'm a little concerned that since that's private data, the background check is, that we might need to put some belts and suspenders on that language to make sure that the proper guardrails are in place for sharing that private information.
Thank you. Chair Scott, are you satisfied with working with Representative Vang moving forward after we pass this?
Or? Sure.
Okay, and Representative Vang, can you work with Chair Scott on that moving forward to be sure about that?
Yes, and I can speak with Whitney, too, to see what she thinks about this, too.
Perfect.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just add into that, when Mr. Hopkins was reading, it's not entirely clear if it's the results of the background or if on the application for the background, generally speaking, you're going to need to provide probably a Social Security number and other data that would be also date of birth, DOB, maybe driver's license number of this or other states. So there's that information as well. I don't know if that would be turned over as part of this, but just throwing that out there to the bill author. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Chair Johnson?
Chair Lesch, I know this doesn't deal with a lot with this committee, but I just found an issue that needs to be addressed. It's a real serious issue. Because this allows the farms to do processing. One of the things that we learned when we have the CDB bill in public safety is there's no regulations in the manufacturing for the concentration of THC when in the processing part of it. It gets to be very high concentrate. The hemp usually is allowed to be 0.01 to 0.3% THC. They try to extract as much as they can out of it for the manufacturing for these CDB oils. And since they can actually do the processing on, looks like right on the farm, there is no accountability for that concentrate. It's a serious issue. Just last week in one of my schools, we had six young girls were vaping THC, high concentrate. They had to be brought to the emergency room at the hospital. This is a serious issue. We need to get our hands on it as soon as possible. So I think we need to find something with this, and this is a good bill to deal with it, the regulation of those byproducts from the processing.
Well, thank you, Chair Johnson. So there are these slag piles of extract on the farm somewhere, and they mix it up into a vaping thing?
There's no accountability for the byproducts that come from this manufacturing right now. No licensing requirements, no documentation of where it goes.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Egg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding THC in hemp, you don't really necessarily have to worry about, because in the federal farm bill, it defined hemp as THC below 0.3%. In order to be hemp, it has to be below 0.3 THC level threshold. Right now, the agencies do understand CBD is a growing popular product, and they are working closely with various state agencies to make sure that they put consumer safety first. Unfortunately, I don't have Whitney here to talk more about that, but if my testifier has more to add on, then they can.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesch, members, and I understand it's going to be to point that below 0.3%. The thing is, in the processing, to get it to that point, it takes it out, and you have that concentrate. That's a serious issue that not only this committee should be looking at, but also in the public safety issue. So it's an issue that needs, at some point, need to be addressed.
Yeah, Chair Johnson, I got it. I mean, I don't know how soon the legislature is going to have to be dealing with stuff like that, but if you've already got girls going to the hospital and, Kalamazoo or whatever it is, that's going to be an issue for us. So, okay. Any other questions for Representative Vang or the testifier, Mr. Strophas? Who's leaning on the lights? Someone leans on the lights in here every time. Go sit down in a chair. Okay. So apparently Representative Richardson wants to go and be in the lights. Okay. Any other questions?
Mr.
Representative Herr.
Chair Lesch, not necessarily a question, but I just want to make sure, because I'm still learning here too, but really as the judiciary group, we are just really focusing on some of the key points of this bill that pertains to our committee, which would be like the data practice piece of it, right? I just want to make sure that that's what we're focusing on as we're moving this bill forward.
It's okay. I'm sorry, Representative, who was that a question for?
That was a question potentially for you.
Okay,
no,
so
okay.
My CA was telling me about the game last night. So,
no,
okay,
I was just
that's what she was telling me. But say it again.
Sure, thank you, Chair Lesch. I just wanted to make sure, because I know, because we're new at this, and I appreciate Representative Scott or Chair Scott's point about looking at the data practices. And I just want to make sure that as we're looking at this bill, What we're doing in this committee is looking at the pieces that pertain to us and really voting on those pieces, not whether we agree with hemp or whether we think it's good for our economy or not. We're really looking at those pieces to ensure that we're moving forward what pertains to this bill, right?
Sure.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Okay, thank you, Representative. For any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Strophas.
Mr. Chair, representatives, if I could just address, first of all, on the data practices, I think just a comment is that the background check is required for the licensure. So if the commissioner conveys that this is a licensed hemp grower, then by default, the assumption is made that they passed the background check. So I don't necessarily know that the commissioner's intent is to share the results and details of that other than to validate that this person or company is, in fact, a licensed grower. And then just a comment, we are not a CBD extractor or processor on farm. Most farms are not, and they're relying on the infrastructure being built by companies today, in addition to potentially working with Minnesota cannabis, medical cannabis companies to do that as part of a wholesale process. It's no doubt that industrial hemp with less than 0.3% THC in the processing process, you're consolidating all the material of those plants. You're taking hundreds of pounds of material and you're condensing it into a very small fluid amount. And with that, you're concentrating everything in it. So, of course, there's potential and probability that THC is aggregating along with all of the other things. But that doesn't make it a marketable, saleable product to a consumer. Let's be very clear about that. This is something that happens in a wholesale process and is not sold to consumer. We're still regulated on the consumer sales side that we have to be in compliance with the 0.3% or less. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the author or Mr. Strophas? Anyone else from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 1661? Mr. Lehman,
I think. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Tom Lehman here on behalf of Minnesota Medical Solutions. We're one of the two medical cannabis manufacturers in the state. I just wanted to thank Representative Vang for carrying this bill. We've been working with her on this. CBD is a major component in the medicines that we produce. You may have heard of the children who have greatly benefited. Who used to suffer from seizures and other conditions. Those medicines are CBD concentrated. The majority of the medicines that we produce have a larger amount of CBD than THC, and so this will allow us to have a new source of that very important product, and we appreciate your support for this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lehman. Questions for Mr. Lehman? Seeing none, then the chair renews his motion that House File 1661 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion to reconsider House File 1246 be recommended to be referred to Ways and Means.
So, okay, so the bill is still in our possession, so that mesh, that motion is in order. The motion is that House File 1246 be recommended to be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Lucero?
And just point of parliamentary inquiry, to make the motion, does one have to be on the prevailing side?
Mr. Representative Lucero, not in committee. And I did check into that. Last night, too, actually. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that you have to have the motion for reconsideration, then you have to re-vote on the bill, correct?
That's correct, yes. Yes. So the motion is to reconsider the vote on House File 1246. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
The motion prevails. The motion then from Representative Neuer is that House File 1246 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like a roll call on that.
Roll call has been requested. Any discussion? Then the clerk will, or the committee legislative assistant will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Barr?
No.
Representative Cantrell?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Considine?
Yes.
Representative Hassan? Representative Herr?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Mariani? Representative Noor?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Zhang?
Yes.
A vote of 8-6, the motion does pass. No, motion passes. The bill is re-referred to Ways and Means. Is Representative Richard, what's that? Oh, I thought we were going to do, I thought Representative Richardson's was easier. Oh. You got to get back. Is that the story? Mm-hmm. Okay, come on, Representative Moran. Come on up here. Okay. Yeah, send some of my members from your committee back over here, okay?
Mr. Chair, she has.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay, so Representative Liebling moves that House File 342 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Representative Moran, welcome to the committee. Tell us about your bill.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to bring this bill before your committee. So House File 342, it is my belief and our belief that we all share the value that families belong together. All children in Minnesota, no matter their geographic location, their socioeconomic status, or cultural background, deserve to live in a safe, loving home that nurtured positive development. Children depend on having a stable environment to call home, and with the sense of belonging, community, and culture that it brings. This plays an important role in their prospect of future success. Unfortunately, there are deep systemic disparities within the Minnesota Child Protection System. There are failing children and parents alike in the African American community and children who are disproportionately represented in the Minnesota Child Welfare System. I both heard stories from communities and have seen data that shows that black families are disproportionately represented in out-of-home placement and foster care. We can't sit on the sidelines and wait for improvements to come within this same system. So today before you, House File 342, the Minnesota African American Family Preservation and Child Welfare Disproportionality Act is before you. We know that in Minnesota, a black child is 3 times more likely to be removed from their home than a white child. Once a child is taken away from their family, we know the consequences that can await them. That can range from lack of success in school, highly suspended, to having poor health outcomes and becoming involved in the criminal justice system. This is unacceptable. And as policymakers, we have a shared responsibility to end inequities like this. Legislators, both Democrats and Republicans, should share the goal of keeping families together. Fundamentally, families belong together. The Minnesota African American Family Preservation and Child Welfare Disproportionality Act will end the unfair, arbitrary removal of African American children from their homes. It will increase the chances if a child is removed from their home that they will be able to stay with another family member, as opposed to a foster family of strangers. The bill creates an African American Child Welfare Oversight Council to monitor case plans and services to ensure the unique needs of black children and children who are disproportionately involved in the system will have their needs met. It supports the best interests of children and promotes the stability and security of children disproportionately involved in Minnesota child welfare system through enhanced, customized, reasonable efforts to prevent removal from their family. It also promotes strategies in areas such as employment, education, and housing to strengthen opportunities instead of separating children from their families. And the bills require that African-American cultural competency training for individuals working within the child protection system. We know that healthy families are vital to the success of our children, and ultimately our state. Everyone has a stake in ensuring that the Minnesota child protection system is fair and equitable. I am committed to working with all stakeholders to ensure that we are enacting needed changes like those contained within this bill to ensure that our child protection system truly has the best interests of all of Minnesota children in mind. Just ask that you help us address the disparities faced by families. Bill House File 342.
Thank you. Are there questions for the bill author? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Moran, for being here. And I know that you and I share that desire for families to be together as much as they possibly can, and we understand that that is the backbone of our civilization, really, is the family. So I thank you for your passion for that. And I do have some questions, and they're all related to data sharing and access to some personal data and those sorts of things. And one of my concerns, of course, is that, let me ask you a question. Are the meetings of this commission or council, are those going to be open to the public?
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. They, as far as I believe, they are not open to the public.
Not when we're discussing personal expenses.
Right. So it's my belief that as long as the council has before them personal cases of families or children, that it would not be open for public viewing or input.
Chair Scott.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Moran, so are there other examples in state government where a council like this would meet behind closed doors?
Yeah, we have, Mr. Chair, and maybe you could talk a little bit about this, but I do know we also have what we call citizen review panels who meet to look at foul cases of children to see whether or not case plans have been followed, whether or not the needs of the child is being taken care of. And so it's just the same type of model. They are sworn that everything that they are looking at is not to be shared with others or taken beyond that meeting of the citizen review panel. There are several located, one located in Ramsey County, Hennepin County, Anoka County, and maybe Washington County right now. And I know there's others trying to bring a citizen review panel to St. Louis County.
Thank you, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the things that I found kind of eye-opening and eyebrow-raising was the fact that this council is asking for access to police investigative data. And that has always traditionally been non-public data while the investigation is going on, and then afterwards it is public. But so I'm just wondering how you plan on getting a hold of investigative data while it's still active, because I don't think anything in the bill specifies that it's not active. So.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I do have a testifier here. I'd like for her to introduce herself and the work she has done, and maybe she can also respond to that question.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Khalees Houston, founder of Village Arms. It's a nonprofit that I started to aid and assist African American families impacted by child protection, and I also chair the NAACP's Child Protection Committee. The Citizens Review Panel does meet behind closed doors to review cases. They have that right, written in statute, and those are private gatherings. The police investigative data would be included in the case file, so it wouldn't necessarily be while the investigation is ongoing, but once it's included in that child protection case file.
Chair Scott.
Thank you. And how about the medical records? Would it be the same with that?
Yes.
Ms. Houston.
Ms. Cavuti, Chair.
Yes, Chair. It would be the same.
Chair Scott.
And I also note that there's access to personnel data, which is classified. Thank you, Mr. Chair, which is classified confidential. And so you're going to even have access to personnel data?
So all
Ms. Houston.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. So the information would be included in the case file. So it would be personnel data regarding the investigator, the ongoing social worker supervisor. So it would be information that would be included in the personal child protection case.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just don't have much of a level of comfort with all this data sharing and a council having access to all kinds of information. Well, Mr. Chair, the people whose medical information that you're going to be accessing, will they be able to provide consent?
Ms. Houston?
Chair, yes, they will. And it wouldn't be anything other than what's already in the case file. So we're talking about specific child protection cases, reviewing those for the purpose of making sure that the family received services, that all of the different processes and protocols were followed. So we wouldn't be asking parents for their medical records or any personnel or personal information. We put the information in there to outline what we would have access to. And these are things that are in the child protection cases and some child protection cases.
Chair Scott.
So if it's in for a failure to thrive allegation, we would have information from a medical provider. If it was in for alleged abuse by a parent or guardian, we would have the police's report and information on that. So we wouldn't go above and beyond what's in the child protection case.
Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And so at the very minimum, I would think that you would need something in this bill's language that provides consent to access anyone's, especially medical information. And there may be other things in here that probably need to be fixed as well. But is that something that you would entertain? Is just some language to put in here that says that you must provide consent to the person whose medical information you're going to be seeing?
Okay.
Or their guardian.
Thank you. Was that a question, Chair Scott?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead, Ms. Houston.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, we would. The Citizens Review Panel has access to all this information, and it's no different than what we're asking for the council. So we would, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Ms. Houston, it may be frustrating to hear all these issues about the nuances of data sharing, but this committee gets super hyped up about it.
I understand, and I'm not against sharing anything more than we should, so I understand.
Well, and I will offer this to you as well. I very much support this bill. I have a leg in kind of both camps on this, because I've seen the child protection system, and I've seen sometimes how they deal with folks. I mean, I've had clients who, they don't care. You know, you could send them to jail. You could fine them to the ends of the earth. You could put them on probation for whatever. But once you talk about taking their kid from them, I mean, that is absolutely the nail in the coffin. And I see the effect this has on all parents. And I have no doubt, based upon how the system is structured, that it's worse for African-American parents. I have no doubt about that. And sometimes the unfairness inherent in the system is horrendous. It ruins people's lives. Mm-hmm. And yet I also understand, because of how I am, the concerns over the data piece as well. So, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to offer the A14 amendment.
Okay.
And if I could speak to that, Mr. Chair.
Go to the amendment, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I was reading the definitions, the entire bill, I came across the definitions on page 2, subdivision 2, which begins in line 2.3.
Mr. Chair, real quick, can I get a copy of the amendment?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
The definition of African-American child is a child having having origins in any of the black racial groups of Africa. And what struck me when I was reading this is I have both met and I know people that are African-American that aren't black, and I also know black people that aren't African-American. And so there are many people that, are born, just personally, I know several people, born, raised, South Africa, they're 100% African, but again, they're not black. So that's what stuck out at me when I was reading this language, is it didn't seem to be very inclusive. So I didn't know if it was the bill author's intent, if the focus was black or African. And as I was listening to the bill author's introduction and opening comments, I noticed she used both those terms, black and African-American. And again, I know people that are African-American, that are black and not African-American, and African-American not black. So I was just hoping that the committee would entertain this amendment to be more inclusive of those who are not, again, black, but are from African or African descent.
Do you want to speak to that, Chair Moran?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero. One of the things that I want members to understand that the safety and well-being of all kids is really important, right? And so in Subdivision 8, when we talk about the disproportionate represented child, which covers whether, you know, we look at race and culture, ethnicity, language, sexual orientation, religion, disability status. These are all, you know, protected statuses. It really covers that too. But in saying that, I have no, I can accept the amendment, so, just in case we're missing someone or anyone.
Okay, so Chair Moran, you consider this a friendly amendment?
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. All in favor of the A14 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Anything else, Representative Lucero?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I won't ask any questions. I'll just, because the bill author did say that she was willing to work with Representative Scott on these, and just some of the things back on the data portions on page 11, as I thoughts that came to my mind are like autopsy records. I don't know. I've had in my own experience of deaths in my family, obtaining death certificates, that is an extremely difficult process, and it's very narrow in who can get access to those. So I don't know if autopsy records are normally included in the case files, or if that would be a separate. I would be actually shocked if they were included in case files. So I would think that's probably going to be a different process to obtain that. But then the other things that, with all of this data, medical records, autopsy records, just a tremendous amount of data here, is this digital or is it hard copy, these records? I'm sure it's probably a combination of both. And then how is that information shared? If it's digital, how is it going to be transmitted? If it's hard copy, how is it transmitted? Once it's received by the council, how is it going to be destroyed? And then what is the retention? Or how is it stored, and then how is it destroyed? So just questions to consider as the bill author continues to work on this. Thank you.
Understood. Thank you, Representative Lucero. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the bill's author, do you see any of the provisions in this that would be in conflict with the bill you brought us the other day, Heaven's Law?
Chair Moran.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, one of, let me just be clear, you know, I am really a strong parent advocate. I am. Yeah. You know, and believe that, you know, parents' rights are important. But a huge part of me also believes in the well-being and safety of kids. And sometimes we get it wrong. Sometimes kids do not need to be with their parents. And if the case is, as stated in this document here, this bill here, is to say that when they cannot be with their parent, that they can be with a relative, which is in the same case as the case I brought, the bill I brought before around Heaven's Law. She was placed with her auntie, who allowed her to thrive, right? And our goal in this bill is to make sure that we are looking at the well-being of children, you know, but also protecting parents' rights. I think we can do both, you know. But when we recognize that it wasn't in the best interest of children to be with their parent, we want them to be with a relative. We want them to be connected to their community. We want them to be of value that we hold as a state. And so in this bill, we're not talking about egregious acts and things like that. We want to remove kids from those type of environments, right? Because our goal is to help kids to thrive and to be the best that they can be in a healthy, thriving, stable, nurturing environment. So no, long statement to that. No, I don't think it's in conflict because we want to keep kids safe.
Chair Considine.
Okay, thank you for that explanation.
Good. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Moran. Thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. Certainly, we know that there's a lot of issues when it comes to child protection. And we have had through this committee that the number of child protection cases have gone up for the very reason that we want to address those challenges. And we have seen many kids who are taken from their family. There's a huge, you know, this impacts people, African Americans mostly disproportionately. So thank you so much for bringing this forward. I look forward to seeing it, its passage.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, when you're working on the data practices language with Chair Scott, I had a couple of concerns of my own that I hope you would address. Lines 1130 and 1130, 11.30 and 11.31. 30 says may the data may be disclosed as necessary to carry out the purposes of the council, and the next line is the data are not subject to subpoena or discovery. It just seems very contradictory or one-sided to me, and I would hope you'd address that issue as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Barr. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Moran. I appreciate what you're trying to do here. I've been in the unfortunate position where I've had to remove children from homes. It's heart-wrenching. But it's done by law enforcement to look after the best interest of a child. We do not like doing it. And before we do that, we call in child protection and, or family services. We discuss it very carefully with them beforehand. I've taken children out of some very bad situations. And at least in my county, we've done everything we can to reunite the children with their parents. Unfortunately, there's been a couple cases where we're unable to do that. But when you go to court 2-3 weeks later at the court hearings, you see those children. It's usually a place you've been to more than once. You've gotten to know these kids in bad situations. But when you see them in court 2-3 weeks later, they're smiling. They're happy. They're a different child. Law enforcement, this the last thing, and even the child protection workers I've worked with, the last thing they ever want to do is remove a child from a family. And like I say, I understand where you're going with this. I have one minor issue with this. I grew up where all people were equal.
I did.
The way I was raised, everybody was the same. Our governor campaigned on one Minnesota. We're one people. We're one state where everybody is equal. And unfortunately, I believe this bill doesn't do that. If we're going to do something like this, it should be for every child, not just certain children.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Moran.
Representative Johnson. I grew up in a state, in a country where we were not all treated equally. And that's just a fact of the history that we have in America. And I think we cannot negate that or dismiss it, right? Because we live this every single day and we're reminded of it all the time. As I step into, whether it's a local store, whether it's here at the Capitol, I am reminded that I am an African American woman. We just know, right? And so our children are a product of that too, right? And it happens from generation to generation to generation. It's not just African Americans, Native Americans, who are highly disproportionately impacted by the system too, right? And so, like you, I believe that all children should be safe. Absolutely believe that. And when children need to be removed from home because it's an unsafe environment, the second option for this bill is that they are placed with a family. Often African-American children are not placed with relatives. They don't go to their grandmothers. I would be appalled
if anything was to happen to my grandkids, and the first point of contact was not me. And this is not just once, it's often. That's the pathway. And so what we are saying in this bill, that when kids are removed, they need to be removed, and often it's for arbitrary reasons, that the first point of contact should be for relative. Because the fact is, we live in a country where we're not all treated equal. And we have a child protection system that shows us that. We look at the number, look at the data, it's there. And data is important to me, just like private data stuff is important to you. Data is important to me. It's real. It tells us a story. It's a story that it tells us. So we don't want to be unfair, but we want to be equitable. Mm-hmm. We want it to be equitable. We want it to work for all of Minnesota kids. Because I believe we need to be a one Minnesota. And I believe in the state of Minnesota, we can be a one Minnesota. But it has to be intentional. Mm-hmm. It has to be intentional. Otherwise, we would believe that we all grew up in a fair state where everyone was treated equally. That is not so.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's very hard to follow that statement. Thank you so much. Representative Moran, I just wanted to tell members that you didn't have the benefit, most of you, of hearing the previous hearings on this bill. And I didn't really know much. I don't follow child protection that closely, but when the hearings that we had on this bill before were so compelling, I wish every member could have been there. Because two things. One is understanding what Representative Moran was just explaining about how African-American and other kids of color really are treated differently in the system. And the second piece is the incredible detrimental impact it has on children when they get removed from their homes, even if the home they're removed from isn't the one that we would say would be ideal for us. But that, so in child protection, as has been said, we are making these very difficult judgments because kids need to be safe. But removing them from their home is also an extremely deep trauma. And I know you all know that. We just had a lot of discussion in a big hearing on equal shared parenting. It's really the same issue. It's not just that a parent feels tremendous trauma when they're separated from their child. Children feel trauma when they're separated from their parents. And that's really what we have to pay attention to. That trauma impacts not only the entire life of the child, and the life of the community, it also impacts our state budget, frankly, in many, many ways. And child protection, you know, is now that I have this piece to worry about, right, the finances of our health and human services system, this is a huge cost driver in our counties, and in many ways it impacts our entire state. So I am so grateful to Representative Moran for bringing this issue forward, putting a spotlight on it. And I'm very glad to hear Representative Scott say that she's willing to help because this has been difficult. It's a new thing that Representative Moran is trying to tackle an issue that is extremely difficult to tackle. But it is a very, very real and extremely important issue. So if members can, like Representative Scott, I'm so appreciative that you're willing to help her with this bill because it will take, you know, it's not perfect yet. It still needs... we need to get this into the very best form that we can. But I also want to respond a bit, even though Representative Moran did a masterful job of responding. I just want to say that we had a training at the beginning of this session about implicit bias. And if you all remember, we saw a film about we saw a black man stealing a bicycle, a white man stealing a bicycle, and an attractive young white woman stealing a bicycle, right? Does everybody remember that? And we saw how differently the different responses they got based on who they were, only who they were, what they looked like, right? This is implicit bias. So how can we deny that this impacts what we do? I mean, unless, you know, I just thought that was such an eye-opening illustration of this, that we white people walk around every day thinking the world is fair, to everyone, but it's not. People are seen differently based on what they look like. And as Representative Moran said so eloquently, we have to pay attention to that. We have to be intentional about that issue, or it will never go away. We can't just say everyone should be treated the same. Yes, they should be, but it doesn't happen on its own. And so this is such an important area. When we talk about disparities, the opportunity gap in this state, this is one of the big places where it begins. So I really appreciate the members who are going to help with this bill. And I think this is going to be one of those issues that it starts here, and we're going to, you know, in 2, 3, 4 years, every legislator is going to say, well, of course this is going on, and of course we have to be dealing with it, and it's going to gain that kind of traction because she is shining a spotlight on a huge issue for us, and we're going to have to do something about it just because of, you know, because it's the right thing to do, but also it's the thing to do for all of us and all of our constituents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Moran, for bringing this bill. I also have the privilege of being on HHS and heard the other powerful testimony that Chair Liebling is referencing. And I agree that this is something we have to tackle. I'm also new to this issue, so between that hearing and today, I've done some discussions with people in my church who are very active foster parents. We have a whole thing going on in my church about foster care. And multiple families of many different races are involved, and it's a really wonderful effort to help meet the needs of a lot of these kids. So I agree with the idea that you stated so eloquently that the first point of contact, if it can't be the parent, should be a relative. And I do agree with the idea of keeping kids in their culture and with their families to the extent possible. But to Chair Considine's point, the Heaven's Law example very clearly shows that sometimes the parent is not the right choice, and the consequences are beyond tragic. And so my concern with this bill, although I support where you're heading with it, I'm very concerned with areas like 5.27, where it says social service agencies shall comply with the custodial parent's or legal custody request to temporarily place the child with a relative. And then if that relative in the next section has reasons that would normally disqualify them, they have reasonable time to fix it. And I understand the intent of that, but in earlier there's language, I believe it was section 2, talking about how the court shall comply. And it seems very prescriptive in a way that I would tend to think we have to create a standard where the first point of contact is the parent and then the relative. But I don't think we should have the language so strong as saying shall comply to the court or to the social service agencies, because in some cases it might not work. And then these kids are in limbo because they're told they shall comply. But meanwhile, we're waiting to fix these disqualifying factors. What is happening to those kids? And so I just feel like it's better to let the court and the local service agencies have the flexibility with a stated goal of first point of contact being the relative and family reunification. But for best interests of the child's sake, I do see a lot of examples in my local community where getting them into a very stable foster situation, still with the goal of reunifying with the family, is a much better option for the child. So I just am not comfortable with the strength of this language, even though I strongly support your goal, Chair Moran. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And bringing it back to the considerations that were before this committee, bringing you back to page 11, what Representative Barr pointed out, 11.30, I was sitting here thinking about all of that, and all of this data, police investigative data, autopsy information, health records, it goes on and on and on, may be disclosed as necessary to carry out the purpose of the council. My question is, When would it be disclosed, and what, can you give us some examples of when you would deem it necessary to disclose confidential and non-public data?
Chair Moran.
Again, the information would, Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, sorry. Again, the information would be included in the child protection case file, so we wouldn't be asking for anything above and beyond what is already included in the case file.
So, Neil?
In the purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think that the language clearly spells that out, which is what Representative Scott was so concerned about. My question was, what would you do with the data, and what situations specifically would you disclose non-public and confidential data?
Ms. Houston?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We wouldn't disclose it. The information that would be shared would be for the purpose of the meeting to discuss the protocol and process that took place in the case. The Oversight Council is to provide oversight of the Department of Human Services as well as the Child Protection Department as they're working for and within the African American community. The purpose of the council's review of the case file would be to make sure that that family received the services that they should have and that the legislative safeguards that we have in place were followed in the case. It wouldn't be to share the information or to exploit it. And these would all be people that have been appointed by the commissioner, professionals, and would be responsible for signing any consent forms, just like the Citizens Review Panel and other advisory councils.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you have this confidential data, you have this non-public data, you're discussing it in the meeting, but the language doesn't contain it to the meeting. It says carry out. It literally says anything necessary to carry out the purpose of the council could extend past that meeting, and I'm asking you for situations past the meeting. So what action will that council take after the meeting adjourns?
Mr. Chair, for Mr. Chair, what line are you reading that states that it will be past that meeting? What line is that?
Mr.
That
Chair.
States that?
11.30?
Yes.
Okay.
It may not be disclosed as necessary. May be disclosed as necessary to carry out the purpose of the. I say notwithstanding the data.
And the purpose of the council again is just to make sure that DHS and the county child welfare departments are following the law and process and protocol as it relates to their engagement with the African American community. So that disclosure would not go beyond the child welfare department handling the case. And the Department of Human Services.
Well, if maybe I could ask this, Ms. Houston. I do see this language as a little bit overly permissive and maybe a little bit of a speed bump. And I'm wondering if you would be willing to work with folks who have concerns, just because I know what you're trying to do. I know the intent. I think it's good. The data piece is something that this committee is always very much concerned about. And I know we have someone from Minkoji here. Did you want to be heard on this relative to the conversation that's going on right now?
And Mr. Chair, if there's anyone from research that can tell us, can read Section 1302 that we're referencing, because if maybe we are more detailed on what 13.02 reference, we can know that is that the work is that is going to take place is done among the council members. And so I think we need maybe someone who can reference 1302.
Okay.
As defined in Section 1302.
Okay, Mr. Hopkins, did you want to speak to that?
Mr. Chair and members, I could look up the definitions for you. Generally protected non-public or confidential information is the highest class of protection that the Data Practices Act affords to government data. Unlike private data on individuals, which are available to the subject of the data, confidential data or protected non-public information is not even available to the subject of the information, himself, herself, itself. So that's what those terms mean.
Thank you. Mr. Ealing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As I was saying, Representative Moran and I had a chance to talk briefly beforehand, and we'd like to come to an accommodation on some of the data issues, particularly the access to public data, given that this is a new governmental body, and we try to kind of look across new governmental entities that are created as they come into being to ensure that they're complying with existing provisions of the Data Practices Act and the Open Meeting Law. So we've submitted our written comments on some possible changes. I'd be happy to take questions, but just wanted to get on the record that we are happy to have a conversation about this going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Chair Moran, is anything is submitted in the proposal from Minkoji, is any of that like a deal breaker that you, from what you've seen so far?
No, I'm very open to making sure that we are keeping, you know, the records of members and children who are in protected custody private. Only needs to be seen by the Oversight Council. So however we can clear that up and make it clear so that we're not going beyond the work of the council or open or exposing, you know, people private information to the public, I'm willing to do that.
Excellent. Thank you. Chair Johnson. Oh, no, you're good. Okay. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given what Mr. Hopkins just read, that there is data that pertains to a subject that the subject doesn't have access to, but that other third parties might have access to, as I'm looking at this, it may have been asked before and I missed the answer, but the catalyst for this, does the subject of that would be in this review of a particular case file, is the catalyst based on an initiation by that subject or their parent or guardian? Or it could the body here, the council, could they begin the process to obtain all these records without the knowledge or permission of the subject?
Chair Moran.
What I do know, and maybe it would be helpful to bring in a model that is being utilized by the Citizen Review Panel. That is, and the Citizen Review Panel, this is a more heavy DHS panel, probably too heavy.
Too heavy.
Because, you know, DHS can't have oversight of DHS. It just doesn't work in my mind. You know, so it's probably a little bit too heavy. But the Citizen Review Panel within itself is just ordinary citizens who are volunteering their time to kind of like do an oversight of the cases of children who are going through child protection, right? And they're sworn, their signatures that they have to, you know, they are sworn to keep that data privacy as they are overviewing cases. So it may be helpful for you to see something that's already in practice to help you visualize just what is the scope of this council. And it's really just on the case file. Just the case file. And the case file, I don't believe, is private information for a parent when they're, I don't believe.
Cases are.
Ms. Houston.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair. Cases are public. So you can go to the courthouse, the self-help center, and put in a parent's name and pull up their child protection case. There is confidential data included in there that you wouldn't have access to. I served as a guardian ad litem, a cultural specialist guardian ad litem for 3 years, and I also served on Hennepin County Citizen Review Panel. So I, as a guardian ad litem, had access to the confidential data in the file, but anyone can go to the self-help center and pull up a person's child protection case. It is public information. The Citizens Review Panel, we had access to cases if needed and would come in or be brought in by the Department of Human Services to review certain cases. Of course, we would have to sign a confidentiality form prior to, but we did have access to those. And it's in statute that the purpose of the Citizens Review Panel, that's one of their purposes, is to review the cases. So this isn't any different than that. We wouldn't be asking for any information above and beyond what's in that child protection case just to make sure that that family was served as they should have been.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And based on that, it almost sounds like then I'm interpreting answers to be a case file is a physical folder with physical hard copy documents in it.
Folder.
Yeah. It's, but I don't know if that's entirely the case, that there might be exceptions, but that's part of it. But then the next part is that case file can that be opened up and reviewed per this language by a third party, by a member of the council or the council as a whole, without the knowledge or permission of the subject of whose file it is, or their guardian ad litem, or their guardian. So again, I'm getting the impression that that can be viewed without the knowledge or permission. And that is another area of concern for me, because with all this information in here that is incredibly private, again, just a concern. I don't like when you have third parties reviewing information without permission, or let alone even knowledge that their private information is being viewed. But anyway, just throwing that out there as continuing to work on this language. So thank you.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if, you know, this is all kind of new to us here in this committee. We're not used to these citizens' councils and so forth. But when you have a council such as this or others that have been set up, are those people, are they liable for the information that they're seeing? So if it would get out improperly, can that ever come back to them? Is there any liability on their part?
Well, I imagine that'd be a data practices breach under Chapter 13, which is $2,000 a pop, but it's only civil penalty. I don't know, maybe research could answer that.
Mr. Chair and members, so this would be a government entity under the Minnesota Data Practices Act, so it could be subject to penalties if it violates the Minnesota Data Practices Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions for any of the testifiers? Chair Johnson?
I was just wondering, the statement, Chair Lesh, the statement was made that child protection case records are public. I've been on a few cases, and I remember that the judge always cleared the courthouse because they were private. And I don't, and I'm trying to remember if I've had to try to look some of those cases up on the public records. And I don't think those, the actual documents in the case itself might be on there that the case was there, but the actual reports and stuff, I don't believe because they're a child, they are private. I don't believe they're public information. I believe it's all private.
Mr. Chair.
Because they're a child.
Oh, sorry.
Ms. Houston.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I served as a guardian ad litem for 3 years. And because the information is public, if it was a case involving a sexually abused child, we could not use that child's name. So we would have to say child one, child two, and child three. Do I agree that those child protection cases are accessible to anyone coming to the self-help center? No. But I myself, along with the ombudsman, for the advocacy that we do on child protection cases, have gone to the self-help center to pull up specific child protection cases, and I instruct parents to do that all the time.
Okay, Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, the guardian ad litems and all those are court-appointed people. They have access to that. I know of one case that I was involved in. I just tried to pull up the records, and I could not. So a lot of this data that you might be looking, think is public, is not. The actual the case itself is there, but the information involving the case is not.
Mr. Chair, I
okay, Ms. Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do this all the time and have done it for years. I don't have any reason to give false testimony today.
No one's accusing you of giving false testimony, Ms. Houston. I mean, sometimes there are different perspectives on this. So, go ahead, Ms. Houston.
Thank you, Chair. I was just going to say the only way that it wouldn't be is if, so we had a case one time where a mom was a domestic violence victim, and because she was afraid that the perpetrator would have access to her address, they made her case private. So it wasn't accessible to the public, but the other cases are.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering if we could actually hear from Mr. Ealing. I know he got off work to come here today,
yeah.
And I'd like
Mr.
to hear
Ealing,
his testimony.
Did you want to speak to this, Mr. Ealing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. If it's helpful, I'll just sort of go through the points, the suggestions we have, and if there's any questions, I'm happy to take them. Looking to lines 11.27 through 11.30, this deals with this question of data being accessed or shared with the council, data coming into the council. And all of that data, once it's in the council, is essentially classified as protected, non-public, or confidential. Now, under Minnesota Statutes 1303, Subdivision 4, which is what we call the traveling data provision, data maintains its initial classification when it travels to another government entity. So if it's not public at the originating point, it stays non-public where it ends up. So in this case, if the council receives investigative police records and so forth, those would remain confidential or protected non-public when the council receives them. Our concern is that when the council receives public information, that would be, under the language here in those lines, would be converted to not public information by virtue of the way the language is phrased. So we'd like to make that change so that if the council receives public information, it's still public at the council. And another line that we would look at would be the conclusions of the council in the lines 11.31 to 12.5. It says those may be released. We'd like to ensure that the conclusions and records of the council are public information, except for information that is not public. So if there's not public data cited in there, that could be withheld. So we have a couple suggested changes along those lines. And then we would like to take out the line that says that a person who participates in council meetings may not basically say anything about what happened at the council meetings, mostly because that could be a prior restraint First Amendment problem. If you have, and it also establishes a precedential issue, if you have a government entity at which the participants cannot say what transpired. So those are the main issues we'd like to.
What line is that?
That is in 12.7. Thank you. But,
Mr. Chair.
Chair Moran.
And I think we can work with some of the things you said. But what I've been hearing from members is that private data information is private. And now you want a member who's on a council to delete them from not sharing that information and make it public. And we believe case files are the case files, and that should not go beyond that meeting. But you're saying is we are stifling people of First Amendment rights.
Representative Moran, Mr. Chairman, and members, we believe that anything that is confidential or private or otherwise not public shared with the council can remain so. Our concern is that because of the way the language is structured, it could also block access to the general proceedings, meeting notes of who attended, those sorts of things that are useful for government oversight. So if we can carve out a way to protect that data as public, but ensure that the not public information shared with the council remains not public, that would satisfy our concerns.
Chair Moran?
I think we can, Mr. Chair, okay. I think we can continue to work together.
Yeah. Thank you. That's helpful. Chair Moran, the data nerds around here are pretty good.
Okay.
And they track this stuff thoroughly going through and, are pretty neutral about, content. So I would encourage you to work with them on that. Chair Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I'm not as good a data nerd as many on this committee, but I do share a lot of the same concerns. And so this bill, I believe, would be going to Ways and Means and then to HHS Finance. And so I think ultimately it's intended, I think, that it be carried in the HHS Finance bill. And I would pledge to members that we will work out these issues. I think it's it would be unreasonable to think that we could leave here committee today with all of these issues really worked out to everybody's satisfaction. But I'm really heartened that Representative Scott and our testifier here and others are really interested in working on this. I know Representative Moran wants to get this right because this is obviously not her area either, this data wonky stuff. But we really do want to get this right. So I will pledge to members that we will not include this in an omnibus bill until we get a pretty good, maybe not everybody can always be happy with everything, but we will absolutely work with people to get this to be right before we before we move it from out of the HHS Finance Committee.
Real quick to that point, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I sit here and process and read all this through. So I just have one clarification question that I'd like. And as back to line 11.30, you use the word, to carry out the purposes of the council. And so I read through the bill, and you have in section 2, so it's page 1, section 2, purposes of the council. So is it your intention that when you use the word purposes of the council to mirror the purposes in section 2, which is on starts in line 1.13. Is that, yeah, so on page one, you have purposes of the council, and you have three different purposes. So my question is that when you're referencing, and this is important to the data, like when can you, what can you do with the data and when and why? And so it says may be disclosed as necessary to carry out the purposes of the council. So I said, okay, well, what are the purposes of the council? I asked that question, but I didn't, wasn't really satisfied with the answer. But then I looked in the bill itself, and it has section 2, which is on page 1, purposes, which is the purposes of the council. Is your intent to, because, again, you're talking about really, really, really private data, confidential data. So is your intent then, when you say purposes of the council, to mean the ones that are stated in the bill?
Chair,
does it mean something else?
Yes, the purposes of the council under the outline and definition in the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Rep. O'Neill. This was going to be real quick.
I'm sorry. It got more complicated. So can you please put a reference to, because it's you have it as 260.62. Can you make a direct reference back to that? Because otherwise it just seems really open-ended to me, and someone could interpret that and say, well, the purpose of the council is to make sure the public is aware of something, something, and then somehow it's leaked or it's out in the press or whatever, even though the sentences after that clearly say you shouldn't do that, but words matter. And so if you would circle that back to the purposes at the beginning, which is that 260.62, then that's tighter, you know, so it's a closed loop of what you're talking about. That'd be my only suggestion there.
Thank you. Yeah, I have no problem with that. I guess I kind of just assumed that we were talking about the purposes as outlined on page one, but.
Never assume.
Yes.
Ms. Houston, yes. This is like being in a committee full of lawyers who are going to lawyer the hell out of your bill. It's just, you're just one of those things you just got to deal with. No, apologies, but.
No worries. Know.
Yeah, words do matter, I guess. Reps and Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, whichever one of the three wants to answer back to this. So subdivision 5.11.11, it goes through, you know, can the following data and specific case review under this subdivision. So if you're talking about case review, and then in number six, under that list of things to be reviewed, which is 1122, line 1122, it says employees' performance, personal data related to employees' performance, but that shouldn't really have much bearing on what's going into the case, right? That would be something that should be referred. If you got an employee with a problem and you're working on their issues of how they're handling themselves, their personal stuff, employee performance, wouldn't that be reviewed by their boss or their direct supervisor as opposed to being part of the case file?
So that's
Ms. Houston.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I apologize. I'm not meaning to overlook you. So the personnel data related to an employee's performance and discharge and child protection responsibilities, that is in there because what we're seeing is that the legislative safeguards that we have in place and the child protection law that we have in place is not being followed by some child protection staff. So we have relatives that are often told that they don't qualify for placement without being allowed to intervene. We have parents being kind of, I don't want to say coerced, but coerced to agree to voluntary termination of parental rights. There's a lot of employee misconduct that's come to the attention of the NAACP branch regarding child protection across races. And so that provision is there to ensure that we have some oversight for that.
Mr. Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Whitney. It's Whitney, right?
Kalise.
I'm sorry. My bad.
We use last names here, though, in committee, though, Rep. Barr.
Kalise Houston.
Houston. Oh, okay. That was Whitney earlier Houston. This morning. Oh. My problem.
Oh,
my bad.
Okay.
Earlier this morning. Wouldn't it maybe a better way to say this would be put this in a different paragraph so that when you find parents that have been coerced, and I'm not saying there isn't because I can imagine, you know, the screws being put to people from time to time, voluntary termination of parental rights, shouldn't there be maybe an oversight or say that there's the council could come back after the fact and go back to after these employees that are coercing that? I don't know if I'm saying that right or not,
Mr.
but
Chair.
Kind of a separate thing. It's not necessarily that it's reviewed in the file, but that you have another mechanism that can come back and actually hold the case officers to count that they're actually following the legislative intent.
Ms. Houston.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. So that could actually be moved to the employee misconduct portion of the bill so that it's separate. Thank you.
Okay, real quick. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, a little bit after hearing Representative Barrs, I'd also throw in the supervisor. He's supposed to be watching that. But I just want to make one quick comment on the purpose. Representative O'Neill brought that out. And I look at it to prevent stability and represent children and families and establish a minimum standard to prevent arbitrary, unnecessary removal of all children. We should never be taking a child out of a home unless it's absolutely needed. And Representative Moran, I understand why you're doing this. Because if there's employees doing this in violation of state law, they should be dealt with immediately. Our children are too important. And we need to do what we can to protect all the children.
Thank you. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. And I guess maybe I'm hearing a lot of questions, which I think are really good questions, and the concerns are really great concerns, and it sounds like the bill author is willing to work with people. I just want to and I feel like a lot of these questions maybe are coming up because maybe we don't understand the structures, the departments, how people actually work and how their job are defined. This is not something new. Like in the Police Review Commission in St. Paul, there are confidential police cases and files in which people who are part of a commission review these things, and that there are parts of those meetings that are public, the parts that people would need in order for the government oversight piece of it, but there's pieces that have then become confidential and they're closed, and then where we discuss the actual pieces of the cases, and so we're not reinventing the wheel here. So I feel like maybe if we have questions around structures and operations and responsibilities, that maybe those are the things that we take offline and have a conversation with the bill author and the people involved within this. And then maybe look at language that other, and though it is a city that is doing this, like in St. Paul, we could look at the language that they've used and how they protect data and how it is that they're able to operate in the way that they do to review cases and to keep that confidential and to make sure that things that shouldn't be accessible aren't. And so I think that this is really great discussion, but I almost feel like maybe this is not the right place to be having some of this discussion, and that we maybe need to dig deeper into it with the bill author and the people who are involved in this in each of the department and different institutions that make up what's going to happen here.
Quick.
Really quick?
Real quick, yes. You did bring me a shake, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. But to that point, if we take it offline, I think I understand the intent of what you're saying. If we take it off, this is before the committee now for us to have this conversation in the public. If we take it offline, the public doesn't get to hear the conversations, the really good conversations that were taking place here, to formulate language that Minnesota residents are going to have to abide by. And that's why there is a productive purpose as well by having this.
Okay, so you know what? Here's the deal. We're about to get into ping pong here right now on whether stuff should be done in committee or not. We're not going to do that, okay? I think we've pretty much exhausted everything we can about this bill. I think we've gotten into a lot of detail. I think the bill author is very clear on what the concerns are, and she's also expressed her willingness to work with stakeholders and making sure that happens. So we can wax eloquent about the philosophy of what's open and what's not, but I you know, let's move on. I closing comments, but Representative Moran, I would say that, you know, the power of government to take your kids away, I think is one of the worst powers. I mean, it's arguably worse than the power to imprison. For a lot of people that I know, that is significant. I've seen families devastated by it. I've seen white families devastated by it too. I have no problem with us focusing this on African American families, because I grew up like a lot of people in this state under the principle and believing that all people are created equal. And I know it said men, but we assumed that meant everyone. And then you deal with the fact that for the last 150 years, it hasn't been equal. It just hasn't. It's not. It's not equal. And so you either have to decide, with all these disparities in education, in income, in housing, all these disparities that everyone knows exists, you have to decide, well, do I really believe that everyone's equal? Or am I just going to decide that I think maybe they're not equal because of the reality? So I think that's why it's absolutely appropriate to focus it in this way, Representative Moran. I support you in that, and thanks for being willing to work with folks on the data pieces. Final comments.
Final comments. This is a good bill. You know, inequities are within our child protection system. Family is the foundation. Is foundational in the African, Black, African American community. And we just want a process that looks to family first, remove kids if necessary, keep kids connected to what they know and what they trust and what they feel is safe, because we're paying for it in so many other ways when kids are being traumatized over and over and over. And so my hope that through this bill, through House File 342, that we can reimagine this child protection system in a way that is creating a one Minnesota where all our kids are valued and all our families are valued. Thank you.
Which motion was it? Representative Zhang renews his motion that House File 342. Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 342 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Is that right? Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. You're on your way. Thank you to the testifiers and to Chair Moran.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Richardson, thank you for your patience. Thanks for not leaning on the lights anymore either. Appreciate that. Come on up. Who's ever with you? Welcome to the committee, Representative Richardson. Representative Richardson, is this your first time presenting in front of this committee? Oh, yeah, you just had HF9, that's right. Dodged a bullet. Okay, welcome. So the motion on House File 1957 is that it be recommended to be placed on the general register, and that motion is made by Representative Noor. Thank you, Representative Noor. Representative Richardson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1957 is actually an agency bill, but Tricia Grimes is testifying in the Senate at the moment. But basically, the bill will codify language related to data practices for post-secondary students. There are four sections with changes proposed in the legislation related to data practices that I can walk you through very quickly. The Office of Higher Education provides consumer protection services to students. Section 1 of the bill would add student complaint data to a list of data that is not public. Currently, schools are required to inform students that they can file complaints with the Office of Higher Education, and on occasion, the office gets requests for student complaint data from outside parties, such as the media, so they just want to be able to insert language that talks about that not being public. While the office responds, the data is not currently public under data practices. This would be a specific statute that they could point to. The second change is in Section 2, and it delineates what data is public and what is not public. In addition to the complaint data under Section 1, the office also gets requests to share accreditation data. The Department of Administration agrees that this data is private, but suggested that that language be added to the section to make it clearer. The office also has a set of consumer protection statutes for institutions that provide degrees, and another set of statutes that provide protection for those entities that grant either certificates of or diplomas. Section 3 provides that the data would be private for schools that provide degrees, and Section 4 provides that this data would be private for schools that provide certificates or diplomas.
Excellent. Thank you. Questions for Representative Richardson? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 1, line 1.21, 1.22, wondering, so this is about the data, or the student complaint, excuse me. What happens if that student doesn't want their information shared with law enforcement?
Representative Richardson.
That would be a great question for the department.
Department here? Come on
up. They're actually presenting in the Senate at the moment.
Of course they are. Okay. Well, what do you want to do about that, Representative O'Neill? We could recess.
What's the bill? We just have your bill after this, Mr. Chair?
No, we're done. This is our last bill.
Oh, this is our last bill?
We did the revisers bill first thing up.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lucero.
Since this is our last bill, I have tons of questions here.
Bet you do. Am I not surprised?
Just one question.
Representative Lucero.
So when looking at the 2.19 on the back side, student complaint data are private. And so I'm thinking, I was just conferring here with Representative Johnson. So in the law enforcement context, when there's a criminal complaint of some kind and it's under investigation, it's not public, but at the conclusion of that investigation, then it becomes available public information. So I'm just thinking along those lines, then using that as a parallel, if there's student complaint data, it appears that even after resolution that it would still be private. I don't know if that's a change from current law or if this is just reinforcing current law or is this changing current law?
Representative Richardson.
Again, I think that would be a great question for the department. Who's presenting in the Senate right now?
Well, Representative Lucero, if you wanted to try to ask that of research, you could, but I don't know. What do you want to do?
I can take it offline, too. More of an inquiry.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative O'Neill, did you want to follow up in terms of how you wanted to deal with yours?
Yeah, I was just debating whether or not. So, Mr. Chair, maybe it would help me if nonpartisan research could just help me understand what the statutory reference is on line 1.22, and maybe that would kind of answer that question as to the data contained within this complaint and where it can go, where it can't.
Okay.
Maybe that might answer it.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, members, so those references at 1.22 are to other sections within the bill. So 136A.672 subdivision 6 is section 3 of the bill. 136A.8295 subdivision 6 is section 4 of the bill. These are two different areas within the higher education chapters. One applies to private and out-of-state public post-secondary institutions, and the other applies to private career schools. Okay. That's why you see a very similar language in two different places, because one is in the act that applies to private career schools, and one is in the act that applies to private and out-of-state public post-secondary institutions.
Wow, I'm just impressed every time they do stuff like that. They just pull it up on their phones and just deliver.
He just earned his pay for the day.
Pretty, I don't know. I just think it's pretty cool.
You get another shamrock.
I couldn't do that. So it's kind of neat. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. No, that does help. Okay, because I used to serve on the higher ed committee and was vice chair and did a big bill about sexual assault on college campuses, and I had to incorporate every single college campus in the state of Minnesota, and so I'm a little bit familiar with this section of law. Okay, I think what I'm going to do is I'll just take that question offline since the agency is not here to even answer, what their intent was, because I don't see it really spelled out in the language as to what the intent is if the student doesn't want it shared outside of the institution. So I'll just follow it up with the agency, I guess.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if the bill's author knows this or not, but do you know the length of time that the Office of Higher Education keeps or retains the complaint data?
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, no, I'm not aware of that.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Otherwise, we're going to vote on this. Is that the engrossment?
Yeah.
Okay. Members, we got the actual engrossment. What's, if I could have research just detail what's the difference? I know it's a very minimal difference, but what is it?
Mr. Chair, so in a member's packets was the bill as introduced. The bill was heard and amended in the Higher Ed Committee. So this committee should have the first engrossment, which is being passed out right now. The only difference between the as introduced version and the first engrossment is that the first engrossment contains a cross-reference to the definition section of Chapter 13, where it states private data in sections 3 and 4 of the bill. So you need the first, you need the proper version in front of the committee in order for the committee to act on the bill. So you have that now, but there's no substantial difference between the as introduced version you were previously reading and the first engrossment that's being passed out now. It's purely a technical amendment that was passed in higher ed.
Okay. So Representative Knorr revises his motion that House File 1957, the first engrossment, be referred to. Yeah, to be referred to, be recommended to be placed on the general register. That's the revised motion. Okay, we're going to vote on this. Any questions? All in favor of Representative Neuer's motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Okay. We don't have anything else, right?
Mr. Chair.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if House File 631's committee report has been adopted?
The committee report has been adopted?
Mm-hmm.
No, it hasn't.
It hasn't? My understanding then is that it's still in the possession of this committee if the committee report has not been adopted.
Okay. Can we get an opinion from research on that? They're not, I know they're going to say they're not parliamentarians, but.
Mr. Chair, no, we don't know, have an answer to that.
When would we adopt the committee report? Just on the floor. That's adopted on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, the chair will entertain the motion then.
Mr. Chair, I would move to reconsider House File 631 and then move to reconsider the A3 amendment.
Okay. Well. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion passes. House File 631 is before us. Chair Scott.
I would move to reconsider House File, or excuse me, the D3? A3 amendment.
Okay. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
A4.
Representative Carlson.
So to let's to refresh the committee on what's before us, especially for some of our newer members.
Representative Carlson, I'm not going to let you filibuster. So you make your statement on what this is. I don't think we need a refresher. You can speak to the motion.
Okay. So the message before us, the amendment before us, is to reconsider. Again, if they could repeat just so that we know what it is that's before us real quick.
It's the A3 amendment.
The Mueller amendment from yesterday.
Okay. Can we get a copy of the...
31.
Mr. Chair, can we get a copy of the amendment, please? I think that's fair.
We don't have a copy of the amendment. It's the same one that was considered last night.
Yes, Mr. but
Carlson.
We don't have it in front of us now, Mr. Chair.
No, we do not.
We do not. And I think for... Again, to the comments made earlier, to truly have a public discussion and to have a full... transparency in terms of what it is we're voting on, I think we should have the bill in front of us.
Duly noted. Any other comments? Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know what a filibuster is. I'm still learning, and that's not what I'm trying to. I just want to make sure I understand the process because I actually don't know what's happening right now. So can someone just maybe just explain to me, because I know that there were some oral amendments to the maybe I'm not remembering correctly, but there was an oral amendment to the amendment too, and yes. So can somebody just read it so that I know what it is that we're voting on right now? Is it the original amendment the way it was, or was it the way the original amendment came to us, or is it the amendments to that amendment that we're voting on now? Or so I just want to make sure.
Is the A3 amendment as amended? Any other questions? All in favor
with
of
the Mr. Chair?
Motion, Representative Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with regards to that, the if staff could please explain to the committee the amendment to the amendment to the A3 amendment, please.
Representative Carlson?
Mr. Chair.
We just did this last night. Everyone knows exactly what the amendment did and what the motion is.
Can we get a vote to see if people know what the amendment to the amendment is, Chair? Because I think that statement is true.
Chair, that's not what's on the table. That's not on the table.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Representative Chair, Noor.
I'd like to recess until we get a copy of the bill
itself. That's not
yours. Okay. I do not think that is necessary. So we're going to vote on the motion. All in favor of the motion as stated by Chair Scott, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails. What is your next motion, Chair Scott?
I would like to pass the
division.
House File 631.
The chair has already called the motion, so we can do division if you want. All
yes,
in
please.
Favor of the motion, raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 8 in favor. All opposed, raise your hand.
Raise your hands if you're opposed.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's 8-5, so the motion prevails. Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, I would ask for reconsideration of the vote on the A3. And I would ask members to vote no. Or is that what we did?
That's what we just
did. That's why we were confused.
So then do we have to re-vote on, I move that we reconsider 631 then and take the vote on that.
Well, we already did that.
Okay.
House File 631 is on the table.
So we're passing.
And then you moved for the A3 amendment to be essentially the original language reinstated.
Right.
And now we are back on House File 631.
As amended.
Because it's now before the committee as amended, and it hasn't been
sent
anywhere.
I move it then.
Okay. So Chair Scott moves House File 631. Representative Herr.
I just want to state for the record that I really was confused, and it seems like even the party that made the motion didn't know what it was they were voting on, having to ask for clarification. And I don't know what happens in a committee if this is the case, that if you all were still trying to clarify what you just passed, and we were saying we didn't understand what was happening, that I really want to state that for the record. And I don't know where it goes from here in ensuring that what we're doing is fair, because we did have a thorough conversation yesterday. And today now, even the person who made the motion was still needing clarification on what it is we're voting on. So I don't know what the proper words, what the proper procedures are to say that whatever just happened here is extremely unjust.
Chair Scott, you want to vote on this?
Mr. Chair, yes, I move House 631.
Okay.
To the General Register.
Chair Scott moves that we refer House File 631 as amended
Mr.
to the
Chair.
General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. There being no other business before the committee is adjourned.